Morning. It's really good to be here with all of you today. As Mr. Good mentioned, everyone is talking about the feast. It's always a very exciting time of year. We're going to Panama City this year and looking really forward to it. And we're going to talk about something this morning that I think is more of an integral part of God's way of life than we might think about. It's often said that pride is the father of all other vices. And it's fairly easy to draw this conclusion when we observe the things that pride causes us to do, and when we understand how very commonplace it is in our own human nature. I was baptized in 1999, and like many of us who grew up in the church, I had a bit of the delusion that baptism was kind of an end goal of the Christian life. I can pretty clearly remember coming to the realization after a short time that in reality I had just barely gotten started and still had a really long way to go. Throughout our lifetime of learning and growing and overcoming that it takes to develop godly character, we do bump up against pride over and over and over again. The Scottish writer Robert Louis Stevenson said, "Vanity dies hard. In some cases, it outlives the man." And in this observation, there's something very interesting, because when a person dies, we generally tend to focus our memories more on the positive aspects of who they were and tend to view their faults with a bit more charity, if you will. But in some cases, a person's pride or arrogance is so outsized that that's practically all you can remember about the person, and it forms much of their legacy even after death. Now, on the other hand, the opposite can certainly be true as well. There are folks who even after death have service and humility as an entrenched part of their legacy and as an unshakable aspect of who they were. And there are a handful of men in the Bible who fall into this category for a very specific reason. And that reason is typified by a simple statement that John the Baptist made about his own ministry in relation to the ministry of Jesus Christ in John chapter 3, John chapter 3, in verse 30. John the Baptist said, "He, Jesus Christ, must increase, but I must decrease. He must increase, but I must decrease." Now, in terms of resisting and overcoming pride, these words from John are perhaps the most difficult that a person can say. It's one thing to be humble about a job or a position that you've never held, but it's another thing entirely to demonstrate humility when you get replaced by someone else in a job or a position. Nothing brings pride roaring to the forefront quite like the emotion of seeing someone else take your place. But perhaps nothing is a better demonstration of God's character and way of life than being able to do that with grace and humility. There's a Jewish saying that the man who thinks he can live without others is mistaken. The one who thinks others can't live without him is even more deluded. And because pride is so ingrained in our human nature, we all struggle to one degree or another with the delusion of being irreplaceable to some extent. And overcoming that tendency is a crucial part of developing God's holy and righteous character. So this morning, let's take a few minutes to go through the examples of four men in the Bible who demonstrated some pretty tremendous humility by their willingness to be replaced. So first we'll look at the example of Moses. Now Moses, as we know from the scriptures, was recorded as having been a very humble leader. Yet, as with all of us, his character wasn't perfected yet, and there were times where his weaknesses got the better of him. And it was in one such case, at the incident at the waters of Meribah, that Moses inadvertently brought about his own premature replacement. So let's review that story back in Numbers chapter 20. Numbers chapter 20. And starting in verse 1, it says, "Then the children of Israel, the whole congregation, came into the wilderness of Zin in the first month. And the people stayed in Kadesh, and Miriam died there and was buried there. Now there was no water for the congregation, so they gathered together against Moses and Aaron. And the people contended with Moses and spoke, saying, 'If only we had died when our brethren died before the Lord.'" Verse 7, "Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, 'Take the rod, you and your brother Aaron, to gather the congregation together. Speak to the rock before their eyes, and it will yield its water. Thus you shall bring water for them out of the rock and give drink to the congregation and their animals.' So Moses took the rod from before the Lord as he commanded him, and Moses and Aaron gathered the assembly together before the rock. And he said to them, 'Hear now, you rebels, must we bring water out of this rock for you?' Then Moses lifted his hand and struck the rock twice with his rod, and water came out abundantly, and the congregation and their animals drank. Then the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, 'Because you did not believe me to hallow me in the eyes of the children of Israel, therefore you shall not bring this assembly into the land that I have given them.'" So here's a case where God decided to execute judgment and assign a punishment immediately after a transgression. And because Moses failed to exercise self-control and lashed out in that pride and anger, God predetermined the outside limit of Moses' tenure and said that he would not lead Israel into the promised land. And while God didn't state it specifically, the implication was also, of course, that someone else would lead the nation into the promised land of Canaan. And as we can see, and we'll see in a few minutes at the end of the book of Deuteronomy, that's exactly what happened. Now we're going to go through several passages in Deuteronomy that describe Moses' final days and the ascension of Joshua to his position of leadership. And as we do, try to put yourself in Moses' shoes and think about how you would feel in the same circumstances. Let's go to Deuteronomy 31. Deuteronomy 31, verse 1, which says, "Then Moses went and spoke these words to all Israel. He said to them, 'I am 120 years old today. I can no longer go out and come in. Also, the Lord has said to me, you shall not cross over this Jordan.'" Now, an important point to understand here is that Moses was not physically unable to go out and come in, as we'll see at the end of chapter 34 in a few moments. He could not lead the children of Israel now solely as a consequence of his actions at Meribah and God's decision to not allow him to cross the Jordan. Verse 3, "The Lord your God himself crosses before you. He will destroy these nations from before you, and you shall dispossess them. Joshua himself crosses over before you, just as the Lord had said." So here, in addition to Moses being prevented from crossing over, we see that Joshua has been appointed to take his place. Verse 7, "Then Moses called Joshua and said to him in the sight of all Israel, 'Be strong and of good courage, for you must go with this people to the land which the Lord has sworn to their fathers to give them, and you shall cause them to inherit it.'" Now, as this transfer of power proceeds, Moses both willingly steps down and anoints his own replacement. And then, after some more words of encouragement and warning, God told Moses to sing a song that he taught him to warn the people about what would happen if they started to turn away to other gods. Now, chapter 32 records the words of this song that Moses sang after God taught it to him, and it contains two verses that are pretty remarkable to think about Moses singing in the context of his imminent death and replacement. So let's look at chapter 32, verse 3. Again, this is Moses singing. It says, "For I proclaim the name of the Lord and ascribe greatness to our God. He is the rock. His work is perfect. For all his ways are justice, a God of truth and without injustice. Righteous and upright is he." Now remember that while he was singing these words, he was about to die, even though his body had not reached the point of death. You know, periodically, we're reminded that attitude is the most important factor in how we approach life. So again, imagine yourself. Imagine having the attitude to sing those words with whole heart while seeing your own life draw to a close while you're still in good health. Let's go to verse 48. Verse 48 of chapter 32. Then the Lord spoke to Moses that very same day, saying, "Go up this mountain of Abiram, Mount Nebo, which is in the land of Moab, across from Jericho. View the land of Canaan, which I give to the children of Israel as a possession, and die on the mountain which you ascend, and be gathered together to your people, just as Aaron your brother died on Mount Hor and was gathered to his people, because you trespassed against me among the children of Israel at the waters of Meribah." This is a sobering reminder that all actions have consequences, and even the patriarchs didn't get a free pass on reaping the penalty for their poor choices. Let's see the conclusion of the account in chapter 34, starting in verse 4. God speaking to Moses, it says, "Then the Lord said to him, 'This is the land which I swore to give Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, saying, I will give it to your descendants. I have caused you to see it with your eyes, but you shall not cross over there.' So Moses, the servant of the Lord, died there in the land of Moab, according to the word of the Lord. And he, God, buried him in a valley in the land of Moab, opposite Beth Peor, and no one knows his grave to this day. Moses was 120 years old when he died. His eyes were not dim, and his natural vigor was not diminished. The children of Israel wept for Moses in the plains of Moab 30 days, so the days of weeping and mourning for Moses ended. Now Joshua, the son of Nun, was full of the spirit of wisdom, for Moses had laid his hands on him." Now it says here that Moses laid his hands on Joshua, meaning, of course, that he had anointed or ordained him to serve in the office of leadership that he had held. And most men, I think about my own weaknesses, my own attitude, most men would have wanted to lay hands on him a little bit differently in these same circumstances, right? But it was not so with Moses. One more time, picture yourself in his place. Having been raised up as a mighty leader, having led Israel out of Egypt, having spent 40 years leading them through the wilderness, and then willingly stepping back while another man steps forward to take your place right on the doorstep of the promised land. What an incredible testament that is to godly humility in contrast to the ever-present enemy of pride that we face. So the main lesson for us to glean from this episode in Moses' life was that he was willing to be replaced even though he was fully capable of going on. And that's the kind of humility that we too must be developing in our own character. Next, let's look at an example in David's life. Now, this example in David's life is focused more on a particular aspiration that he was passionate about rather than him being replaced as the leader of Israel. 2 Samuel 7 records that David wanted to do something specific and very special for God, but God told him that his son was going to do it instead. Let's go to 2 Samuel 7, 2 Samuel chapter 7. Starting in verse 1, it says, "Now it came to pass when the king was dwelling in his house, and the Lord had given him rest from all his enemies all around, that the king said to Nathan the prophet, 'See now, I dwell in a house of cedar, but the ark of God dwells inside tent curtains.' Then Nathan said to the king, 'Go, do all that is in your heart, for the Lord is with you.'" Now let's try to put ourselves again in David's place. He'd been called out by God from his youth to serve in a special position of authority for a special purpose. And God had literally plucked him out of the sheep fields to become a king. And he'd united all the tribes of the children of Israel under him. And moreover, in contrast to his early days as king, the verse says that now God had helped Israel to have peace all around them by triumphing over their enemies. So it was in that context, no doubt with feelings of gratitude and love for God, that David shared his desire to build a magnificent house for God with Nathan. And I would suspect that David didn't just come out with this on a whim one day as they were sitting there drinking beer out on the porch, I would think much more that this was probably something he had been thinking about and dreaming about, possibly praying about, for quite some time. That's the way it usually happens when you want to do something big and special for someone. Verse 4 of chapter 7, "But it happened that night that the word of the Lord came to Nathan, saying, 'Go and tell my servant David, thus says the Lord, would you build a house for me to dwell in?' Verse 12, 'When your days are fulfilled and you rest with your fathers, I will set up your seed after you, who will come from your body, and I will establish his kingdom. He shall build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever.'" So after some period of time thinking and dreaming and mulling over this particular desire, David finally verbalizes it, and God says that his son is going to fulfill this dream instead. Now, the account in 1 Chronicles 7, where David is instructing Solomon to accomplish this task, provides a bit more insight into why God directed it that way. Let's go to 1 Chronicles 22. Apologize there. 1 Chronicles 22. First Chronicles 22 and verse 8. David speaking, "But the word of the Lord came to me, saying, You have shed much blood and have made great wars. You shall not build a house for my name, because you have shed much blood on the earth in my sight." So this is the reason that God gave. But still, imagine that special vision and dream that David had wanted to accomplish. When we want to do something for someone else, it takes on a great emotional significance to us. And it's pretty clear that David or anyone else in his shoes could have quite easily been a bit offended or hurt that someone else was going to actually get to carry out his special vision and dream. Most of us in the same situation would probably struggle a bit to not be even a bit mad because of the feelings of hurt. But the preceding verses in 1 Chronicles 22 show us that, again, it was not so with David. Instead, he set his heart on making all of the preparations so that his son Solomon could accomplish this goal. Let's look at verse 3 in chapter 22. It says, "And David prepared iron in abundance, and the nails of the doors of the gates for the joints, and bronze in abundance beyond measure, and cedar trees in abundance for the Sidonians, and those from Tyre brought much cedar wood to David. Now David said, 'Solomon, my son, is young and inexperienced, and the house to be built for the Lord must be exceedingly magnificent, famous, and glorious throughout all countries. I will now make preparation for it.' So David made abundant preparations before his death." Now again, what a remarkable example of humility. What a sincere passion for serving and worshiping God in any way that he could. The main lesson that we can glean from this example in David's life is that he was willing to be replaced in this aspect even when it was his big idea, his special dream. And again, that's the kind of humility that we too have to be developing in our own character. Next, we'll look at the prophet Elijah. Now, Elijah prophesied to the northern kingdom of Israel during the reign of King Ahab. And during his tenure as leader of the prophets of that day, God performed many very powerful works and many very powerful miracles by Elijah. So in 1 Kings 17, for example, when Elijah first appears in the scriptural account, he immediately announced the beginning of a 3-year period where there would be no rain, and that period would only end at his word. And later, because of the drought that came about through that period, he had to stay with a widow in Zarephath. Now, when the widow's son died, God caused Elijah to erect this to resurrect this widow's son to physical life. And in that famous showdown with the prophets of Baal at Mount Carmel, it was Elijah's very simple and heartfelt prayer that God answered with fire from heaven that had consumed the sacrifice that he had prepared. Now, in our day and age, we can barely imagine what it would have been like just to be there and to witness something like that in person, let alone to have been the person that God worked through to accomplish something like that. During the reign of Ahab, Elijah was that person that seemed to be the focal point of the work that God wanted to accomplish at that time. But much like Moses and David and everyone before and after them, Elijah was to fill that role only for a time. And he found this out immediately after he heard that famous still small voice on Mount Horeb. Let's look at that account in 1 Kings 19. Verse 13. So it was, when Elijah heard it, the still small voice, that he wrapped his face in his mantle and went out and stood at the entrance of the cave. Suddenly a voice came to him and said, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" And he said, "I have been very zealous for the Lord God of hosts, because the children of Israel have forsaken your covenant, torn down your altars, and killed your prophets with the sword. I alone am left, and they seek to take my life." Then the Lord said to him, "Go, return on your way to the wilderness of Damascus, and when you arrive, anoint Hazael as king over Syria. Also you shall anoint Jehu, the son of Nimshi, as king over Israel. And Elisha, the son of Shaphat, of Abel-Meholah, you shall anoint as prophet in your place." Verse 19. So he departed from there and found Elisha the son of Shaphat, who was plowing with 12 yoke of oxen before him, and he was with the 12th. Then Elijah passed by him and threw his mantle on him. Now, again, let's put ourselves in Elijah's shoes. God had done all of that powerful work, and if he had done that powerful work through us, we might easily feel a bit frustrated and a bit disenfranchised by the simple statement God makes here that it's time for someone else to fill our job and to replace us. Now, there are several similarities here with the example of Moses. Like Moses, Elijah was tasked with anointing his own successor. And also like Moses, there is no indication that Elijah had any impairment of physical health or anything else that would have prevented him from continuing on in the job for some time. Now, unlike Moses, to consider an important contrast, we have no indication that Elijah was removed as a consequence for making any mistake or having done anything wrong. So there could, of course, be some reason that the scripture doesn't mention, but from what we are told, it appears that God was simply ready to place another man in the job that Elijah had been doing. How many of us in that same situation would have dragged our feet a bit maybe on the way to anoint Elisha? Maybe some of us might have even had an urge to take a page out of the Jonah playbook and skip town for a couple of days and just hope that it would all blow over. But it was not so with Elijah. 1 Kings 19 records that he simply went and found Elisha and anointed him. Writing about the difficulties that we often face with our human nature in these types of situations, the New Testament scholar William Barclay commented this. He said, "What jealousies, what heartburnings, what resentfulness we might escape if we would only remember that the success of others is given them by God, and we were prepared to accept God's verdict and God's choice." So what Elijah did, again, is a remarkable example of serving God in the way that God determines is best and according to God's timeline. So the main lesson for us to glean from the example of Elijah is that he was willing to be replaced even though he had been used so powerfully in the work that God did through him. Again, that's the kind of humility that we have to develop in our own character. Fourth and finally, we'll look at John the Baptist. John the Baptist. Now, John is an excellent example to review after discussing Elijah, since Elijah's work was a type of the work that John the Baptist would do prior to the ministry of Jesus Christ. And the crucial thing to understand about John in the context of what we're discussing here is that he had great popularity among the people. And that's certainly not to say that he tried to cultivate this popularity, but nonetheless, the Bible shows that he had it. Mark 11:32 records, "All counted John to have been a prophet indeed." And there's another interesting statement about the impact of John's ministry in Matthew 3. Let's look at Matthew chapter 3. Starting in verse 1, it says, "In those days John the Baptist came preaching in the wilderness of Judea, and saying, 'Repent, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand.' For this is he who was spoken of by the prophet Isaiah, saying, 'The voice of one crying in the wilderness, prepare the way of the Lord, make his path straight.' Now John himself was clothed with camel's hair, and a leather belt around his waist, and his food was locusts and wild honey. Then Jerusalem, all Judea, and all the region around the Jordan went out to him." Now, we don't know exactly how many people that was. The Bible doesn't say in exact numbers. But based on these references to whole cities and regions, we can safely say that there were some pretty massive crowds hanging around down by the river when John was there. And I don't know about you, but if all these people were pouring out of these cities and regions to come and confess their sins and to be baptized by me, I would probably have a major problem with pride, struggling with that enemy that we all have. And humanly, even if you take away that pride and arrogance, just imagine the sense of purpose and ownership and the commitment that you would feel with that ministry and that responsibility that John was carrying out. John's disciples had no trouble expressing the sense of ownership that they felt and the sense of loss that they started to feel as people began to flock to Jesus Christ when he began performing miracles and preaching the gospel of the kingdom. Let's go to John chapter 3. John chapter 3 and see what John the Baptist's disciples said to him. John chapter 3 and verse 26, where it says, "And they came to John and said to him, 'Rabbi, he who is with you beyond the Jordan, to whom you have testified, behold, he is baptizing, and all are coming to him.'" You can almost hear the disappointment and aggravation in their voices. And they shouldn't have been caught off guard by what had occurred, because they themselves remembered that John had testified of Jesus. His message had been very consistent from the beginning. When the Pharisees sent priests and Levites from Jerusalem to inquire about from John about who he was, his testimony very clearly gave preeminence to Jesus Christ. Let's look at that just a couple of pages back in John 1. In verse 15, it says, "John bore witness of him, Jesus Christ, and cried out, saying, 'This was he of whom I said, he who comes after me is preferred before me, for he was before me.'" Verse 26, "John answered them, saying, 'I baptize with water, but there stands one among you whom you do not know. It is he who, coming after me, is preferred before me, whose sandal strap I am not worthy to loose.'" So John had been clear from the beginning, but somehow his disciples hadn't grasped the significance of those statements, or at least they hadn't carried them far enough to the logical conclusion that they foreshadowed. Now again, putting ourselves in John's shoes, even if we were John ourselves, even if we had made those statements with our own mouths, we might very easily fail to comprehend the future implications for our own place in the world. And we could all the more easily fail to do that if we thought very much about how popular we were, right? Because popularity is a great drug. But again, it was not so with John. John responded to his disciples starting in verse 27 of chapter 3. John 3, verse 27. John answered and said, "A man can receive nothing unless it has been given to him from heaven. You yourselves bear me witness that I said, I am not the Christ, but I have been sent before him. He who has the bride is the bridegroom, but the friend of the bridegroom who stands and hears him rejoices greatly because of the bridegroom's voice. Therefore, this joy of mine is fulfilled. He must increase, but I must decrease. Commenting on this section of the account in John, William Barclay writes, it was clear that people were leaving John for Jesus. John's disciples were worried. They did not like to see their master take second place. They did not like to see him abandoned while the crowds flocked out to hear and see this new teacher. In answer to their complaints, it would have been very easy for John to feel injured, neglected, or unjustifiably forgotten. Sometimes a friend's sympathy can be the worst possible thing for us. It can make us feel sorry for ourselves and encourage us to think that we have not had a fair deal. But John had a mind above that. Of course, it wasn't just John himself, but God working with him. But he had a mind above that. And again, what a phenomenal example of laying down a position of service and authority and popularity in John's case for the greater good of the people that you're serving. So the main lesson for us to glean from this example from John the Baptist is that he was willing to be replaced even though he had that great popularity with the masses who followed him. And again, we must be developing that in our own character. So in closing, let's think for just a few moments about what might have happened if the four men whose examples we've reviewed had acted differently when it came time for them to be replaced. What would have happened if Moses, David, Elijah, and John had resisted those realities of their changing roles? And what would have happened if they had tried to hold on to those roles instead of allowing another man to replace them? I think it only takes one word to answer, and that word is division. With the great influence that each of these men wielded, if they had refused to transition gracefully, they would have caused division among the people that they served and led. And to that end, I'd like to close with one comment from an article on problems in the Vatican that was in a recent Economist magazine. Now, much of this piece was focused on the man who's the Secretary of State for the Vatican, a Cardinal Tarcisio Bertone, and he has a lot of critics who have accused him of grabs for power and trying to position himself for the next papal enclave. The most telling bit of the whole article is a single sentence, which concludes this: whatever his ambitions, Cardinal Bertone has proved a singularly divisive figure. A great position of power, and the conclusion about his tenure is that he has been a singularly divisive figure. And what a regrettable description for any person, let alone someone in his position. But sadly, it's a very consistent description of what our human nature is like, influenced by Satan. And it's a very fitting portrayal of what we are like when we're focused on our own desires and ambitions rather than being willing to serve or to not serve in any role that we might fill. So as we've seen today from the examples of these four biblical figures, a servant of God must not be so. He must not be that way. Much rather, we're to be developing the character traits and trust in God that allowed these four men to willingly decrease when another man increased and avoid that spiritual trap of seeing yourself as irreplaceable.